Save big money and transform your home with new appliances now at Menards. We offer the lowest prices and the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade your home and save big money on new appliances at Menards. Shop our entire selection of appliance options online today at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What an interesting moment we are in the Biden administration. And I've been saying for the longest time, I voted for Joe Biden because he is a workers' president, because he is firmly on the ground of fighting for working people and people's ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and his NLRB, his Treasury Department, his vice president, all of those folks moving in the right direction. And I point to today, the big report put out by the White House task force, headed up by Vice President Kamala Harris, that said, hey, guess what? You know that thing Rick Smith's been talking about for 18 years on the radio? How our unions get higher wages, better benefits, better opportunities, how it's good for the economy? Well, they've got a report out today that says just that. Now, they didn't need the Treasury Department to do a big report and spend a lot of time in researching and investigating. They did, but they didn't need to do that. They could have just asked me. And I would have been more than happy to tell them exactly what all of us already know. And for me, the importance of this report, and I'm not mocking the administration because no president in my lifetime has done this before. This is an opportunity to go, look, we've done our homework. We've done the research. We've looked into it. This is the pathway forward. And this is kind of what this marks for the administration. Now, I've been saying all along, all through his presidency, there are moments when the NLRB head makes a decision that moves in a good direction. He said, this is the reason you voted for Biden, to ensure that working people get a fair shot. But like I said, this report, you know, as Kamala Harris said, union workers earn 15% more in pay than non-union workers in the same occupation. Union workers also receive retirement benefits, paid sick leave, life insurance, discounts on child care. And I would add, which I think she forgot to mention, health insurance at a much, much higher rate and better health insurance. So for me, this is extremely encouraging because this is saying that what we've been doing here at the program for all these years is filtering in, saying, hey, and I ask this question a lot. Which are you? Are you a worker first or are you a consumer first? And I know it's a chicken or egg scenario, but it really is telling when you have people who answer it. And what I have found over the 18 years of asking that very simple question is I don't need to ask you who you voted for in the last election. I know by the answer of that question. If you say I'm a worker first because it's how I make my living, it's how I support my family, it's how I get all of these things, chances are, overwhelmingly, you vote for a Democrat. If you're a consumer first and it's all about, you know, cheap goods and hooray for me, chances are you're going the other direction. And it's this hyper individualist. I'm not quite sure what the rationale is, but that's how it's broken out for me. So to have Biden come up and say, look, we're breaking from the past. We're breaking from all of the supply side voodoo Reaganomics. We're breaking from neoliberalism. We're going to start making things here. We're going to start investing here. We're going to start bringing jobs back here. And we're going to make sure that those workers, when those jobs come back, make a decent living, make a good living to where work actually pays. And, you know, because I go back to the Reagan era. Reagan always said, you know, the best anti-poverty program is a job. And I've always amended that to say, no, not just a job, because there are a lot of McJobs out there, but a union job, one with superior wages, benefits, all that stuff. This is what the administration is picking up. And this is what they're moving forward. And that is a good thing. And again, I come back to the idea that this administration, and say what you want about Biden. And look, I've got problems with his inability to give a speech. I've got problems with, you know, all kinds of, it's his policies. It's the direction that he is slowly, quietly moving this country. I wish we were a little louder about it, and I will be loud for him because I think he is doing the right things. We've got to say this is what we want, though. Because remember, you go back to the Trump era. And this is what I have a problem with my working class Trump folks, because Biden is doing exactly what they believed Donald Trump was going to do. Take on China, reshore manufacturing, invest in infrastructure, all of those things that my union brothers and sisters who were waving the red flag and wearing the red hat were saying were important to them, Biden is doing. So it's one thing to have a PR stunt. It's one thing to do your photo op, you know, wear the funny little hat, drive the little truck, do whatever he's going to do. It's one thing to have Trump's show. It's another thing to just quietly pick up your jelly bucket and get to work. And I tell you, that's what Jelly Bucket Joe has been doing, man. And I give him credit for it. Now, the business community, not thrilled. Because what this means is their hands are no longer planted at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel. They are no longer in complete control. This idea that workers should have some voice, they're not taking well. And you look at what happened on Friday for all my union brothers and sisters. Friday was an important day because those who have listened to the show know that I've said for years that the way my grandparents' generation organized unions to where they got up to 35% union density and created the most prosperous, wealthiest working class in the history of civilization, how they did it was a government that encouraged people to join and form unions, bargain collectively for the profits that were extracted from consumers, and make their lives better. I've always said that. And I've always said that the law has to be slightly tilted towards workers, as the NLRA is, to make sure that workers have a shot. Because what the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, understood is that the employer has all the rights, has all the power, has all the control. They control what you do, when you do it, how you do it, where, how, what, why, when, all that stuff. They control every aspect of your day. Employees, workers, needed a little balance. And that's what the NLRA did, gave them the opportunity to say, hey, we want to have some say in the workplace. That is a good thing. And Biden's moving us back to this. Now, the decision on Friday, the announcement Friday by the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is saying we're going to change some things up. We're going to return to some old ideas that worked really well. And one of them is this CEMEX decision that is going to, the hope, break down on union busting. Because currently, if you're an employer and your workers want to organize, you're going to go out and you're going to hire a union busting firm who, to be honest, it would be malpractice for them not to tell you to break the law because the penalties are so minuscule, and the payoff is so big. It would be malpractice not to. What this is now saying is, look, if your workers come to the employer and say, we've got the cards, we've got our intention is to form a union, a company has the ability to, one, recognize that and begin bargaining. And that's what happened a lot in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Two, they can demand an election. And that has to be done in a timely fashion without harassment and intimidation and firing workers and unfair labor practices. Now, if the employer says, hey, we're going to demand this election, and they break the rules. And the big one was Amazon in Birmingham, Alabama. You may remember us talking about how they were plastering things in the bathroom stalls, how they had cameras everywhere, how the ballot box was a mailbox that they dropped and had cameras all over it, all kinds of unfair labor practices. And I said at the time that the NLRB should impose the union upon them. That, sorry, you screwed the election up. You have tainted the pool. It's over. You now have to begin bargaining. That's what this does. This is potentially a game changer to help people organize and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and to be able to, I don't know, think of themselves as workers first, making sure that their pockets have enough money in it to put food on the table, a roof over their kids' head, opportunities for the future, healthcare, retirement security, the things that we as working people view as that American dream, what my generation viewed as almost a birthright going into the workplace. This is, to steal a Joe Bidenism, a big freaking deal. And the hope is that we move on this. Now, this is an election issue too. Because as the administration has done this, as they have put people into these positions to make these decisions, Donald Trump, Vivek Ramaswamy, Ron DeSantis, any Republican, generic Republican top to bottom, is going to come in and completely undo this. For working people, this should be a voting issue. This should be a huge voting issue because this is how you support your family. This is that kitchen table economics stuff. This is the stuff that gives you opportunities. And I speak solely for myself. As a kid growing up in the projects, because of that union card I've carried in my wallet all these years, I've lived a life that I could not have imagined as a kid. My kids will never see the horrible that I grew up around because the work I do was fairly compensated. I've had health security, been very fortunate. And I'm not bragging. I'm saying I want that for every working person. And we should want that. And this is a move in that direction. Because here's what's happened. And you know it as well as I do. We've turned into the two Americas. Working people are struggling just to keep up with the inflation shocks, to keep up with the rising cost of products, the gouging of corporate America. The CEO class, man, they're doing well. And I point to this guy who's the head of Procter & Gamble. His name is John Moeller. John got a 23% raise last year. Did you get a 23% raise last year alone? Now, this is him taking 23% increase and his workers getting an 8% decrease in wages. How's that happen? Well, it happens because these workers don't have bargaining power to sit down across the table from John there and say, wait a second, you got 23 million? You got a 23% raise and you want us to take a pay cut from 60,000 down to, or from 69,000 down to 64,000? Explain that. So for me, this is a good thing. This is a step in the right direction, and I give the Biden administration credit, and I'm looking forward to moving on this in big ways. But I want to hear your thoughts. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I just see this as too big of a deal, but this could be a game changer. This could give us the working class economy that our grandparents' generation built. And, as someone who's looking down the road going, retirement may be coming soon. What am I going to leave my kids? This is a start. this is an opportunity to maybe do a little better than I did. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So let me ask you, you know, Nikki Haley becomes president. Do you think the woman who said that we've got the lowest unionization rate in South Carolina is because I wear pointy shoes and I kick those unions where it hurts? Do you think she's going to undo what the Biden administration has done to help working people? You bet your sweet. Fill in the blank. Okay. Because this is the woman who was on Bloomberg TV today, I believe it was. And she said that, you know, that retirement age at 65, way too low, way too low. I know. Sorry, kids. You know, we've done all this damage. We're not going to undo it. We've been doing damage to the economy for decades, to Social Security, to Medicare. You're just going to have to work longer for less and have less opportunities in the future. Sorry, that's just how it is. But understand, these folks, they hate working people. They probably couldn't find one if their life depended on it. Yet, working people vote for them. You could make the argument that Reagan, while one of the worst possible presidents for working people, at least was somewhere between the curbs, wasn't completely hostile to working people, at least could talk to them. This current Republican Party is not that party. And look, you know, there was that moment in the debate with Vivek Ramaswamy and Mike Pence, where, you know, Ramaswamy actually used the Morning in America frame as kind of a pejorative almost to attack the party, you know, basically saying, hey, Grandpa, we're not that party anymore. And it got me thinking about the, you know, the current Republican Party, who unrecognizable to a Reagan type voter. Perfect example. I was reading this report of Tucker Carlson being in Hungary. And understand, he's someone who I question whose payroll he's on. I question whether he's on the Russian payroll, because here's a guy who, in my view, is anti-American, just period, flat out. Going on to foreign soil, saying that the Biden administration blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, going on foreign soil, saying that, you know, that was an act of war, basically siding with someone else, saying, oh, well, look what we did. And then, you know, saying that NATO is going to collapse because of the U.S., this kind of stuff. I'm sorry, the Republican Party that I grew up around, they wouldn't have stood for this. But this seems to be the mainstream thought right now of a lot of the Republican hierarchy. And it's a split within the party right now. I mean, they're struggling. Because you have this. And understand, this is on both sides. This is red hat, blue hat stuff. Where if one side is doing something and they're for it, the other side automatically, reflexively, has to be against it. And I've never lived in that kind of world. I'm a policy person. I want to know what your policies are. How are you going to use our government, the levers of power, to make lives better? And Republicans don't seem to have any of those levers. There's nothing that they bring to the table that I've seen yet. And I hope someone will say, no, Rick, they want to do all these wonderful things to help working people. It's just it's in a secret location. It's in an undisclosed secret location in a skiff somewhere. Maybe it exists. I haven't seen it. Maybe it is in Area 51 for all. Maybe the Martians have it. Because there's a lot more talk about aliens and Martians than there are about getting workers health care, getting workers decent benefits and decent wages and opportunities. There seem to be a lot more talk about aliens. But I look at this and I look at this moment where even you've got the Pope, you've got the freaking Pope talking about the backwardness of conservatives in America. Hello? The Pope? The guy who's supposed to have the red phone right upstairs? Saying, hey, you, How many red flags do we need? And this is where I keep coming back to talking about working people issues. All of the stuff that we're spoon-fed, all of the divisive stuff, all of the stuff that's meant to be reflexive, where if you're for this, you got to be against this. I prefer not to get engaged in that. Because what I know happens, and it's masterful, it works all the time, never fails. If you're distracting people with this nonsense, someone's robbing you blind. And I happened to be watching one of these videos over the weekend of a young woman talking about a silent depression. Now, her numbers, I think, were skewed. I'm not quite sure what orifice she pulled those numbers out. But her argument was during the depression, wages were adjusted for inflation higher than they are now. I wasn't able to corroborate her numbers, but when you looked at it, they were about the same. So when you start looking at the median income back during the depression, wages were lower, but we were in a freaking depression. And this is why I come back to this moment where Biden is doing good stuff. I wholeheartedly support the policies on the economic front, the manufacturing policy, the industrial policy, 100% behind it. And why I think this push today, this report today is important, because this is going to help working people catch up. You know, I've said a bunch of times here on the program that, when I started in the less than truckload trucking industry, that job paid in today's money, $100,000 a year. It was incredibly good paying job because the industry was 85% unionized. You had mass density that you could raise the wages and the benefits and all of that stuff and make it a good, solid, middle class, working class job. Now it's just, you're getting by. So the anger that's out there is real. The frustration is real. People want to make sure that they have the ability to support themselves, their families, the future. But the wages haven't kept up. And there is a sense across all ideologies and all political lines, which is why I think that Oliver Anthony song was so important. And why it's driving the right and the left crazy, because here is a guy who's just, he's telling it like it is. We're struggling out here. And it's these people who, don't seem to listen, don't seem to care. And the anger that comes, the frustration that comes with that. Now, I have my left friend say, they're racist and homophobic. Yeah, probably. But what's that got to do with you and moving an economy forward to make sure everyone has opportunity? The more we divide ourselves, the more the wealth class of this country enjoys it, the happier they are. The more we allow ourselves to be pitted against each other, the less we get. And I've said this a thousand times. My government teacher in high school was very clear. We are the government, and government decides who gets what. So you got to ask yourself, you know, over the last 40 years, what have working people gotten? We've been trained to believe that government is the problem. And what built that working class of our grandparents' generation was an active government of, for, and by we, the working people. So for me, it seems pretty simple. I wanted Joe Biden in the White House. I want Joe Biden's policies coming out of the White House. I want the people he's put in charge of regulatory bodies, ensuring that our air is safe, our water is safe, and our working conditions are safe. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Let's take a quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm telling you, you know, we're in a moment of it's a whole new world. To steal the Reagan frame, it's morning again in America, if you will. You go back to last week with this announcement over the CEMEX thing, and now today with the report coming out saying, hey, you know what? Unions, they do raise wages. They do give people better benefits. This, all of this together is a big freaking deal. And here to share some thoughts on just how big this can and maybe is, I've asked our good friend Seth Goldstein to come talk with us. Seth is a partner at Julian Meyer Singla and Goldstein. They are one of the premier worker rights firms in the country. Seth, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
So Friday, what happened? Walk me through this announcement. Walk me through how important you think this is and what this could mean.
Well, on Friday, the NLRB made a seminal decision in CEMEX Cement, which was a case that involved the Teamsters. The general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, used CEMEX to address three issues. One was Joyce Silk, which many of your listeners and viewers would remember involves voluntary recognition. The second one had to do with captive audience meetings, which was the Babcock-Wilcox case. And the third issue involved TriCasts. So the board passed on captive audience meetings and on TriCasts, but it did use the CEMEX decision to lay out a new framework for voluntary recognition. And it created a process for unions to request recognition and put the burden on the employer to demand a union election.
Right. But you know, but here's the thing, Seth, and this is what I've talked about for years. This is how our grandparents' generation organized. They took cards, they marched on the employer, and they sought recognition, and they started bargaining. There weren't these long, drawn-out periods of workers being harassed, intimidated, fired, and all of this stuff, as I understand it.
Well, it's my understanding, because I know that we have great organizers also, like in the 1930s and 40s, but back then, they had an ability to demand recognition, which is something that we lost probably around 50 years ago when the NLRB jettisoned Joyce Silk and came up with what was called the Gissel framework.
And as I understand, you know, part of the research that I've done on this, it was a misstatement that kind of made that the rule, the law of the land, wasn't it?
Yes. So What happened in the Supreme Court was the board attorney stated that the board had abandoned Joyce Silk, and then the court came up with what was called Gissel, which made it very, very difficult to get bargaining orders. And the significance here is that, and I think this scares management and the union busters because they've been attacking me all day on LinkedIn and Twitter, is that if they commit any unfair labor practice violations, then they're subject to a bargaining order.
Yeah, well, maybe don't break the law, Seth. Maybe don't do it.
Exactly. But there was no consequences previously, because previously all they had was a rerun of the election. So they could union bust all they wanted. And then they faced a union election, which they had fired everybody and, you know, basically coerced people into silence.
Right.
And that is something that the union busters and the law firms are worried about. I know that Morgan Lewis, who represents Trader Joe's and Amazon, is freaking out about this because they put out their strategy statement, you know, online. I posted about it because they're now saying that they're going to demand copies of everybody's names that signed on to union cards, which we know is a violation of the law. But, you know, desperate people do desperate things.
But here's the thing, and this is what I just said a moment ago. You know, in the environment before Friday, if you're one of these union busting firms, it would be, you know, malpractice to not tell an employer to break the rules, to not tell an employer to fire someone, because the penalties were so pathetic. And as you said, you know, the recourse was, well, we would just run another election, but without all of the people who were your most ardent supporters. So there was no downside. This adds a little bit of downside in balance, which is why I think this is a
Absolutely.
This could be a game changer.
Absolutely. Previously, before Jennifer Abruzzo, all you got was a posting in the break room. That's all you got.
Yeah, the dreaded notice.
And you know, people, you know, said it's like toilet paper.
Yeah, I won't do it again until the next time.
Right. And they would sign things. And, you know, Amazon did that for a while. You know, they signed national settlement agreements that they knew they weren't going to keep. And so the board has come up with a really incredible framework with CMEX, but that's not in isolation, because last week they also came up with the final rules for the quick elections too. And, you know, before the board is also captive audience, you know, reconsiderations of Babcock Wilcox and TriCast, which is the ability for the employer to lie during a union campaign. So all these things, I believe, are going to really help a lot. But of course, it takes a union, you know, they have to be willing to adapt to new organizing strategies and collective action.
Right. And politics as well. Look, I mean, you know, I've got a lot of my union friends say, well, you know, unions shouldn't be involved in politics. No, they should, because this is political. This is only happening because Joe Biden is in the White House. I don't care if you do agree with me or not. This is happening because of one guy who put one person in charge to move this in the right direction. And that's why I voted for Joe Biden.
Well, I have to tell you that him and I will be knocking doors for Joe Biden because of this decision. And I urge everyone to remember the consequences of not having a pro-labor president or pro-labor NLRB. And, you know, I came of age during Ronald Reagan, you know, with PACO and every presidency that the Republicans had, the board law got worse and worse. You could see decisions. I think one was issued by Judge Green. And it's amazing how many anti-union decisions came out of the NLRB in the 1980s with Reagan and even before that with Nixon. So, it is very refreshing to have a pro-labor NLRB, a pro-labor Department of Labor.
And I hope come 2024 we keep this, because, you know, while we're celebrating this return to sanity, Nikki Haley gets into the White House, let's say, the woman who said, you know, we've had the lowest union density in South Carolina because she wears pointy toes and kicks unions where it hurts. Do you think she's going to allow that to stand? Of course not.
Nope. And I think that, you know, we've seen that what happens when a right wing government is in place in the United States. People lose all their rights. There was also a policy that they had at the NLRB that if a union organizer that was fired talked to the press, their case would go to Washington to the general counsel's office during the Trump presidency, never to be heard of again. And that was like a non-disclosure agreement for union organizers, because if they talked, they would, you know, their case would die. So, yes, we've had a lot of great things with Jennifer Abruzzo. And this week, I think there's going to be some other great decisions.
No, it's what we need. Now, you know, you listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Seth Goldstein. Seth is a partner at Julian Meyer Singla. And Goldstein, as I said, they're one of the premier worker-centric firms in the country, doing some great work on workers' rights issues. Now, you're, you know, attached to the Amazon Labor Union folks in New York. I was talking about this kind of a thing back when Amazon in Birmingham was doing all of the unfair labor practices and got away with it. I mean, ultimately, you know, harassing people while they're going to the bathroom, you know, putting, you know, cameras everywhere, the ballot box being a mailbox with cameras everywhere, the police harass. I mean, there was just tons of stuff. And I remember saying at the time, this is where the NLRB has to step in and say, you know what? You've screwed up so badly, you're going to have to now bargain. And I'm glad to see that this has happened. Was that a big part of this, do you think?
I think so. I mean, Bessemer was certainly an issue. I would agree with you.
Now, obviously, you guys in New York, the Amazon Labor Union and the folks that you're attached with, they won their election, but still, all of the harassment, all of the intimidation, this is where I keep coming back to, should workers have to put up with that kind of abuse simply because they want to earn a better wage and have better health care and better opportunities for themselves and their families? I guess that's a central question that we have to all ask ourselves, isn't it?
Yes. I think that Amazon has gotten away with a lot. Well, the one thing I would like to see with Amazon is not just the NLRB taking action, but also state governments taking action on their tax abatements. And I also do think that the Biden administration should review their contracts and put pressure on Amazon to, you know, to meet and bargain with ALU. Now, there is a roadmap to this. We see that in Starbucks, Cornell University, because of student pressure, was forced to drop their contract with Starbucks. And I believe that that's starting up at other college campuses. That type of grassroots effort, I think, would go a long way of putting pressure on Amazon.
Yeah, no, that brings me back to the idea of secondary boycotts, which are illegal since Taft-Hartley. I mean, you know, I go back to my grandparents. It was societal. It was every working person understood how important unions were, even if they weren't involved or members of a union, because they understood someone was fighting for their best interests. Do you see us, you know, this being part of moving us back in that kind of societal shift that we once had?
I do. I don't think what is happening with Cornell is a secondary boycott. I think these people are really just tired of the fact that that, you know, their university or their employer deals with companies that are just human rights violators, and that's just freedom of association.
No, I agree with you on that, but I brought that up as, you know, this is a tool that was used in the past by my grandparents' generation, and a lot of it had to do with the people in society who said,
absolutely,
you know what, we're just not going to participate, or we're going to stand with our workers in this at this other company, which, you know, I think is infectious.
Yeah, I think that we are going back to that, where people are standing together. And I think that that is the central premise that is happening. And I think it's being fueled by millennials, Gen Z, workers who, you know, think that they should be treated with decency and respect. So
yeah, but coming out of the pandemic, Seth, I mean, you know, every person was told you're an essential, you're a hero, you're all this stuff. Nobody wants to go back to being treated like crap for poverty wages, and especially now that inflation is putting a pinch on every working person, and we're seeing these corporate profits that are obscene, these CEOs that are lining their pockets. This is a perfect time for this.
Right. So I think that you see this happening all over the country. I will also remark that I have represented undergraduate workers, and they're taking a stand like tomorrow. I have a shout out to the OPEIU workers for Local 153 at Tufts University. There, the undergrads RAs are going to be striking during move-in day. So this is happening everywhere. It's very, very exciting.
No, this the kind of activity is good stuff, and hopefully it builds, and we build an economy that we can be proud of. Last question I've got for you. You know, you've said this CEMEX decision is a big deal. Who's going to be the first one to use it?
Trader Joe's United. We filed today a CEMEX bargaining order, and we are moving forward to challenge the tied election that we had in New York in April. We believe that we had a substantial majority going into the election, and because of union busting, it had ended up in a 76-76 tie. So we're going in there with the demand that Trader Joe's and union busting Morgan Lewis recognize our union and go to the bargaining table.
Well, this will be something for us to watch out for. This will be the test case, and I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again when the good news comes down.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the time, Seth. Thanks so much. Seth Goldstein, he is a partner over at Julian Meyer Sigma and Goldstein. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. This is a big deal? I think it is. Right back after this.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day one of the most important stands for justice and equality took place in United States history. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech to 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. But did you know that one of the main organizers for the march was a man by the name of Baird Rustin? Rustin is often left out of the history books because he was gay and because of his earlier communist affiliations. He was born in 1912 and raised in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He was raised in the Quaker tradition, and his commitment to peaceful, nonviolent protest continued into the civil rights movement. Rustin joined the Young Communist League in the 1930s, a time when communist organizers were some of the few people actively speaking out about racial injustice in the United States. After he left the Young Communist League, Rustin spent a brief time as an organizer for a march on Washington, D.C., planned in the 1940s. This movement was led by one A. Philip Randolph. The planned march was aimed at putting pressure on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to desegregate work at industries with federal wartime manufacturing contracts. When President Roosevelt agreed to issue an order desegregating these jobs, the planned march was called off. But the idea for the march lived on and became a reality during the civil rights movement. Rustin went on to work in the labor movement. He became the founder and first director of the AFL-CIO's A. Philip Randolph Institute, which focuses on tearing down the walls of discrimination in workplaces and within the labor movement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got an email from Darren from North Carolina, who's asking about, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, who he says whose primary talking point seems to be about firing people. Darren writes, I just can't understand how any candidate can get more than two supporters with the message of firing people. He says, as I recall, he wanted Elon Musk to be an advisor, not because of some technological advancement or expertise, but because he fired a lot of people. Donald Trump claimed to fame on The Apprentice with the catchphrase, you're fired. Just tell me, Rick, explain to me how you're fired is a popular policy position. It boggles the mind. And I'll tell you, it boggles my mind too. The only thing I can say is the cruelty is the point. The folks who would be drawn to that, the cruelty is the point, because they don't believe it's going to be them until it is. And then it's catastrophic. Then it's the victim card. You can see this playing out in time after time after time, because they've been fed by right-wing talk radio that they're special. Everybody else is worthless. Everybody else is no good. The others are taking from them. And part of what this latest kind of anger has been is that crowd is waking up to the reality that life hasn't turned out the way that they expected, the way we believed it was supposed to. And now they're doubling down on blaming the others. So the cruelty of you're fired, that's enticing. I get it to them. I don't get it for me, but I get it for them. It's twisted. But I appreciate the email, Darren. Thanks so much. Interesting news today. And I thought about this today a bit on how I was going to handle it. Because Joe, the unlicensed plumber, Samuel Wolfsbacher, he passed away today. Died of pancreatic cancer. He was 49 years old. Now, for those who remember Joe, the unlicensed plumber, he was a right-wing darling for about 15 minutes. Ran against Marcy Kaptur out in Toledo and lost, fortunately. I met Joe, the unlicensed plumber, here in Harrisburg, you know, back when they were the right-wing moneyed people were putting him all over the place to beat up on labor unions. And he was like the front person for the whole secret ballot election thing, and you know how they were fighting against the Employee Free Choice Act, and he was one of the loudest anti-union voices. And when he came to Harrisburg, I'm going to argue that I saved his life back then so that he would at least live more years, because he came to Harrisburg with his fake voting booth that would allow no one to vote, because the unions had a bunch of people there who were willing to go vote and say, yeah, we want card check. We want to be able to do what past generations have been able to do to organize. So they wouldn't let anybody vote, and they were going to go to Philly afterwards. And I had the opportunity to interview him and talk to him for about, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And I said, you know, I told him, don't go to Philly. You're not going to fare well. The people here are mostly supportive. Don't go to Philly. And he didn't. And that was one of those things I say, I kind of saved him. But here's the scary part of this. Here is someone his entire life advocated, you know, you're your own guy. You know, don't worry about licensing requirements. Don't worry about anything. You know, just go do it. So as an unlicensed plumber, you know, he was doing plumbing work. He actually got a job at the Jeep plant in Toledo, a UAW job. I don't know what happened after the big news of that. But we find out a couple of months ago that he's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I see the fundraising request to raise money. And they said, look, as a community of friends, we have set up this medical campaign to support Joe and Katie during these months when Joe is not able to work. I got to know, you know, what kind of health care did Joe have? You know, he couldn't work. Did the employer pick it up? These are a lot of these questions that I got to tell you. I had mixed emotions today. I don't wish anyone ill. I don't wish him. I mourn for his family. This is you know, bad. But what he advocated for was horribly destructive. And not just for himself, but for society as a whole. Now, look, I get he made some money. He was a media figure for a little bit. Wasn't able to take it to that next step. But think of the fact that this is a guy who was the face of stopping the Employee Free Choice Act from happening, which I advocated for solely because of first contract arbitration. Because the one thing with this CMEC decision is that, yeah, you're going to be able to get union recognition, but are you going to ever get a first contract? There's so much more down the road that has to happen. Yeah, you're going to get recognized as a bargaining unit, but the employer's just never going to bargain in good faith. There'll be thousands of meetings to cross I's and dot T's, or cross T's and dot I's, and nothing substantial happening because we don't have the legislation to mandate it. And the moneyed interest knew what they were doing with him. They used him as a divisive figure. Because here's a guy's a working guy. He, you know, we had a good conversation. I didn't have a personal problem with him as a person. Politically, we were completely on different planes, especially on this issue. And I think this is what we have to start regaining. I've seen some horrible comments about this. Our humanity is not worth this kind of vitriol. But again, we do need to fight for policy change. And I come back to, you know, Biden being in the White House. These policies only get to go forward. These policies only get to happen. These policies only get to be enforced if Joe Biden is in the White House, if a Democrat is in the White House right now. You get any of the Republicans, any of the you're fired crowd, any of the cruelty is the point crowd. It all goes away. And I argue the pendulum swings back even harder just to keep you in your place. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, September 14th, the deadline for the UAW. With the big three saying, look, you know, contract or we strike. And what they're asking for, you look at Bloomberg News, again, you know, Bloomberg corporate news. The headline was Union Boss. I always love when they do that. Union Boss wants 46% raise, 32-hour work week, and war against Detroit car makers. Yeah, I love how they frame that, but I think it's all wrong. The working people who create this wealth want to share in it. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, is this reasonable? Is this outrageous? Or is it just right on? I've asked Frank Hammer to come talk with us. Frank's a retired UAW GM International Representative, former UAW 909 President and Chairman, and one of our go-to UAW guys. Frank, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
So let's unpack this headline first, because, you know, as I'm reading through this, my mind just explodes. Union boss wants 46% raise, 32-hour work week in war against Detroit car makers. Is that fair?
Well, the boss part is unfortunately misplaced. They're the bosses, not the president of the UAW. And in fact, this president of this UAW is the first that's been directly elected by the membership. That doesn't make him a boss. That makes him a leader. And he's been filling the role exceptionally well. And you can tell by how much the corporate media is completely rattled that this brother, Sean Fain, is really speaking what is in the hearts and minds of auto workers across the country. And they're responding. They're really feeling that he's with them. And he's so not a boss that he's made a point of being in touch with rank and file workers at gatherings, on social media, every which way that he can to be connected with the rank and file and so that the rank and file can feel connected with him. That doesn't make him a boss. It makes him a leader.
Now, one of the things that I said right at the beginning, I thought he did absolutely brilliant. Was this demand for a 46% raise over the next 4 years? And it's not that he just pulled that number out of thin air. That's what the executive class saw over the last 4 years in raising their compensation. So if it's good enough for them, shouldn't it be good enough for the workers?
So that has a little bit of context. And I think that probably the general public does not know about that context. The context is that the what they call the legacy workers, the tier one workers, have actually had a wage freeze for the past decade. I don't think people know that. Yeah. I don't think that people know that the legacy workers, the tier one, have not had a wage increase all during that time that these executives piled it on and piled it on and piled it on. So right off the bat, really what auto workers are trying to do is catch up with where they were before the bailout in 2009. And I think they've had enough. And never mind the second tier workers and the new hires, the temp workers, who really are in a real big jam because of what they're getting paid is minuscule compared to the cost of living and their life's demands on them.
Yeah.
So I think that it's completely appropriate, and pegging it on the increases of the executives is great for optics and for people to understand this is really tilted way out of whack, and we need to get it right.
But this, for me, Frank, and this is an important moment from the past as well. I mean, there was that old, you know, saying, as GM goes, America goes. You know, the CEO to worker pay back in, you know, my grandparents' generation was like 20-1. Which meant the workers were doing well. The CEOs were doing well. Let's not pretend that they weren't, but the workers were doing well. And, you know, the auto workers were the gold standard of blue collar workers in this country. And as you've pointed out, because of these two tier wage structures, because of concessions, these are not those gold standard jobs. These are just jobs.
Yeah. I think the estimate now is that one of these executives makes 300 or 400 times more than what a rank and file worker makes in general, on average. And even in comparison to contemporary companies like Toyota in Japan, they make maybe 4 to 1 or maybe even 10 to 1, maybe even 20 to 1, but not 340 times what a rank and file worker makes. That's an obscenity. And they're not liking the fact that the mirror is being shown in their face, and this is what you look like.
No, and this is what we should be doing. Now, the other thing that I think is important, and it's been years and years and years, in my view, since a union has advocated for a major shift in labor conditions in this country. The UAW was always a very progressive union, always pushing the bounds of what is possible. So now to see the UAW rise again and say, hey, look, this 40-hour work week we've had for, you know, 80 years, it's time to reconsider this. It's time to maybe start talking about a 32-hour work week, since automation's coming on, robotics, since there are going to be less jobs. This is the right conversation at this moment. While I don't think they're going to get it, I think it's the right conversation, and it's the right demand for our time.
So it comes from a number of different places, but I want to point out that when UAW, when the auto workers occupied the factories at GM and Flint in the mid-30s, one of their demands was for the shorter work week. And there was a moment in time when there was serious legislation being considered to reduce the work week to 32 hours a week and for 40 hours pay. So historically, we're in the right place, and it's like long overdue. But as you pointed out, with the degree of automation that has transpired in our factories, never mind what's going to go on now, but even up till this moment, the productivity of an individual worker is multiplied many, many times, and they've not been compensated for that productivity. And now, to make additional jobs in the industry that's aiming to cut jobs, one of the key ways to doing that is to reduce the work week. And I want to mention the other place where this is coming from is the incredible hours that workers are working now. Right now, Stellantis and GM have workers on basically on a 90-day lockdown. They're obligated to come in 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for 90 days straight. And workers can't cope with this, and they can't cope with their mental health, with their physical health, with their families. And this is partly where this demand is coming from, is we got to shorten the work week. And as President Fain has talked about, we need to make time for our families. We need to make time for our communities. And the only way to do that is shortening the work week.
Yeah, I mean, well, it comes back to that age-old question. Do you work to live or live to work?
Couldn't be said any better than that.
The other part of this that I think is important, because there are a number of facets to this negotiation, which is making this, you know, contentious, difficult, and I can see where they're going to say this is a war, but it is saying, look, we've got to make up for decades, for a lot of years of concessions. We've got to make up for a lot of years of not moving forward and not organizing new members. And one of the key demands in this, and help me with this, is that as we transition to electric vehicles, I got to think these companies are seeing this as an opportunity to maybe, you know, get rid of the UAW as a whole by moving into the new technology. The union saying, oh, wait a second. We want that to be part of this discussion as well, right?
So, yes. And that's, in fact, that is what the UAW has been demanding. And so let's look at this for a minute. I think framework is the fact that we are faced with a climate crisis. We're seeing that everywhere. And we saw that recently in Maui. We're hearing about a hurricane heading to Florida as we speak. And these have intensified. And the planet is wanting to make the transition away from using fossil fuels. So that's the transition that we're talking about. In the auto industry, very belatedly, is making the transition to electric vehicles. And you're right, they're seizing this moment as an opportunity to reset the relations between the capitalists and the workers. And you can see it with the example of the Ultium new battery plant in Ohio, where the UAW won representation. It was initiated as a non-union plant. They started paying at $16.50 an hour, I believe it was.
Yep.
Which is extraordinary, like minimum wage in a sophisticated auto plant. And they're negotiating now and fighting for making it the same level of pay and wages and conditions as our legacy workers at GM and Chrysler or Stellantis and Ford have enjoyed. So the companies are wanting to use these joint ventures to say, oh, well, we can't put you under the master agreement. We have to have separate agreements. And they're using that as a way of scaling back against what working class people need. And what's really bad about this is that it's interfering with a united effort for a just transition to a renewable economy. We need to have everybody on board, and that includes auto workers, and they ought not feel that their jobs are going to be sacrificed in the process.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Frank Hammer. Frank's a retired UAW GM international representative, former UAW 909 president and chairman. Here's the question that I've been asking a lot, because you hit on something I think is really, really important. You know, as we move to this new technology, as we shift gears and we move in a different direction, as with every technological advancement throughout the history of humanity, it's the working people who take it on the chin. It's, you know, when we went from the buggy whips, you know, to cars or whatever, you know, those people who were making a living making those buggy whips, they got left behind. They got screwed out of being able to move and keep up. This time, I hope it's going to be different. I hope it's going to be better. And to see this kind of bargaining that Sean Fain and the UAW are doing to say, look, we're not going to let that happen, I'm somewhat encouraged that maybe this time it won't be so bad from working people. Do you share that hope? Do you share that fear?
So I'm very, very impressed with the quality of leadership that Sean Fain's brought to the table. And I think that a lot of what he's projecting is aspirational. But I want to be, I'm kind of, I've been around long enough in the labor movement. I've been in the labor movement for over 50 years. And I understand the context, and we've been talking about it. When the bailout went down during the financial crisis, the Wall Street, the crisis generated by Wall Street, they used that reset, they used the bankruptcy for restructuring
yep.
of the auto industry. And I know there's a lot of auto workers that believe that we made sacrifices, and when the companies were going to be back on their feet, we were going to get back all of what we gave up because that was the deal. It wasn't the deal. It was a restructuring, and it was like out of Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, that they used the shock of the financial crisis, the companies used it, to shave the UAW and cut auto workers were reasonably expected to live on. They used it to restructure it, to get rid of COLA, to get rid of raises, to even for a while they actually forbid the UAW from striking. This was part of the deal. And I think that we have to recognize that the companies were doing a reset, and we are confronted now with a reset of our own, and that's going to be very, 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 very challenging. The companies didn't see that coming. The companies were set in their ways that they were going to get their way post bailout.
So, last question I've got for you: September 14th is the deadline. Is that a hard deadline? Do you think, is that movable? And do you think the chances on the 15th they're going to be on strike?
So Sean Fain has been, he doesn't mince words. He said it's not a he said. That is the deadline. There's no give in what he's saying. So do I predict that on the 15th, if we don't have an agreement, which I don't think we will, that people will be out on the street and there will be picketing? I believe so. And I think workers are getting prepared. They're having all kinds of what they're calling practice picket lines. And there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of energy. And I think it's likely, I don't know if you'll see it at all three, although Sean Fain right now is saying, if nobody comes forward with a deal, we'll be out at all three. So that'll be a major event. We will not have seen that in many years.
Well, we'll see what happens. I hope you'll keep up with us, keep us up to date on what's going on. Hope you'll come back and share more as this continues.
It'd be my pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Frank Hammer, retired UAW GM. International representative. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
46% raise the executives got over the last 4 years. You know, and you know, they take that without any concern that someone's going to call them on it. That's the amazing part. So when the media goes nuts and goes, they want 46%, didn't question the executives lining their pockets. That's the thing that gets me. That's the thing that it's really amazing to me is that, you know, we allow that to happen. It is what it is. Now, you know, Frank did make an interesting point. You know, when the restructuring happened, never let a good crisis go to waste. Corporate America has done this in industry after industry for years and gotten away with it. Finally, someone has survived long enough to say, no, now we're going to go back and get what we should have had. And as he pointed out, the two-tiered wage structure that they put into place back then, where they have frozen the wages of the people who've been there for decades, so that the lower tier can catch up, should be criminal. And I've bashed two-tier wage systems for a long time. Should have never been allowed to happen. Should have struck over that back then. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So, couple of things here. Number one, these executives and CEOs in the corporations are getting outrageous salaries. The CEO, I forget, I think it was Bob Yeager, I'm not going to swear to it, but he back in 2014 for Disney, his compensation package, his salary was $10 billion. Yes, billion with a B, plus all these stocks and everything else. And it came to something like $25 billion, and I'm not even joking on that, and I know that because there was a game that a lot of friends and I played, and it Disney had bought it, and they just...
Did we lose her? Nope, I think we lost her. No, I mean, you're right, Alice. I mean, these CEOs, they've taken an outrageous amount of money and lined their pockets with it. And for me, the argument being, this is where working people should be angry about it. This is where working people should be all worked up. I don't know about the billion number. I'm going to have to check into that. But, you know, we've seen huge, huge amounts of money going to these handful of people. Now, the weird part of this is, and this is where having a union, I think, is really important. You go back from the end of World War II to the middle 70s, as productivity rose, wages rose. That idea of a meritocracy was then built. That if you do more work, you get more pay, you know, that kind of thing. Well, middle 70s till today, that productivity keeps going up massively. The money going to working people is a deadline. It actually gone down over the last 40 years. So for me, this is one of those moments. This is an important moment that you've got a couple of labor leaders. I look at O'Brien at the Teamsters. I look at Fain at UAW, who are saying, you know what? We're willing to go on these big strikes. We're willing to shut things down. You've got an administration in the White House saying we support workers' ability to do this. And we are encouraging people to join and form unions. This is a moment. Now, understand, and I go back to my MAGA hat-wearing, Trump-supporting union brothers who are, no, Donald Trump is the... What did he do during his tenure? Nothing. He did nothing for working people. There's a lot of talk. There were photo ops. There was all that garbage. But no actual policy. Mock Joe Biden all you want. His policies are going to make your life better. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. When your life is getting better, will you acknowledge it or will you be angry at it? Because the more opportunity we give people to share in the wealth that their labor creates, the better our economy is going to be. And when that happens, we're not talking about what divides us anymore. And that's where I want to get to. Thing that drives me crazy about the left is they're happy to slice and dice themselves into oblivion. And the right is happy to use that to beat everybody over the head with. My union contract doesn't say anything about the person doing the job. Doesn't care if you're white or black or male or female, gay or straight or whatever. It doesn't matter. This is the job. These are the wages. This is the condition. These are the benefits. This is your grievance procedure. This is all of this stuff. And it doesn't matter who you are, the person in that job. You have all of this stuff. It blows my mind that any working person would go, no, I don't want that. It's almost unfathomable when you sit back and you think about it. That no, I would rather be at will and at the whim of someone's anger and firing. Because back to what Darren's email, there is a party in this country, the party of you're fired. The cruelty of that message is something that they have internalized. How does that make sense? If you got an answer, I need to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
What fun. Vivek Ramaswamy. I don't know why I like saying that name so much. And look, you know, he's gotten a lot of attention since the debate. He's now come out and said that he's gonna tap Trump as an advisor. If he wins, Trump's going to be his advisor. I'm sure that's going to go over really well in Trump's twisted little head. Also, Vivek picked up a coveted endorsement, that of O.J. Simpson. O.J. has endorsed the Vivek Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley ticket. I didn't know they were a ticket yet, but that's it. So I know that's an endorsement every candidate, I'm sure. I'm sure Watts. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Maybe get a thought on the endorsement. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. So what do you think of the OJ endorsement? Do you think he's got a point? You think he's got something here? Well, the Ramaswamy Haley ticket?
Well, I'm just going to bite my tongue. My mind is going 1,000 different directions. So I'll just stay to analyzing the OJ endorsement itself. It gives Vivek Ramaswamy the felon vote.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, when you were running, would you have accepted that endorsement?
OJ?
Yeah.
No. I would have said thank you, but I'll run my own campaign, thank you. You know, it's like when these individual people used to run ads and I turned my TV on and see some ad that I didn't approve, and it's on, so I would call and scream the next morning, take that thing off, you know.
Yeah.
Don't do me any favors. Maybe O.J., now this might be Machiavellian, maybe O.J. is actually working for Biden, so he endorses Vivek. Oh. What do you think? Machiavellian.
Yeah, palace intrigue. You think Biden's got that kind of time?
No. you know, people will believe that.
No, and that's why my mind is now going, you know, they thought he learned coding during the pandemic and hacked into all the computers. I got people telling me crazy stuff. So this, not the craziest thing I've heard today.
Okay.
Which is, I think,
saying
something.
You've heard a lot of crazy stuff then today.
Wow. Also on this Ramaswamy front, Eminem, mm-hmm. the rapper, has sent him a cease and desist letter to stop using his music. You see this every once in a while. Politicians use, people's music, and sometimes wrongly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the famous one being, Reagan using Born in the USA without actually understanding what the song's about. Does this matter?
Well, no. I mean, Trump, the Rolling Stones asked Trump not to use their music, I think. And then people have asked on the Democratic side not to use their music, you know, et cetera. That, I mean, that's there. Now, I would say if somebody was, I don't know, super, super prominent and went on and on about it, then maybe you ought to stop using the music. Now, Vivek Ramaswamy, I don't know if you know this, he used to do Eminem cover.
No.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay.
He did, like he was in contests and things. He did Eminem cover. He did rap cover. And in Iowa, did you see him rap in Iowa?
I did. I'm not a rap fan, so I turned it off quickly.
Yeah. He rapped because in, you know, he went to Harvard and Yale. And in college, he was, now I can't remember. I read through the whole thing of these candidates. He was some type of cover rapper. Huh. I mean, he did this. This was like a hobby. So he was an Eminem, you know, guy, and that's why he did 8 Mile at the fair when the music came on. Yeah, he was an Eminem rap cover guy. So,
all right, good for him.
You know, so get the rap vote, maybe.
My problem with Ramaswamy is, you know, miles long. But you know, I guess you know here, you know, recently he said that he would have handled January 6th differently. That he said he would have certified the 2020 elections, though in a different capacity than Vice President Mike Pence. What exactly does that mean in a different capacity? Is there potentially a different capacity?
No.
Okay.
The vice president accepts, you know, I stood in front of Cheney. Cheney was in the speaker's chair. I was down at the front podium there where the president normally speaks, you know, his State of the Union speech. We had John Larson and I think 7 other members. We constituted the Electoral College Board, and we would stand up and call Ohio, Pennsylvania. They stand up now individually. You know, one member had protested the Ohio vote in, you know, 2004, and we had a vote, but somebody calls the vote. And that somebody is, you know, the official vote sent from the state. So Cheney at that time couldn't have done anything, and neither could I have, or the other members with me on the commission could have done anything except to accept the vote. Now, if when the protest vote was called, had that in fact passed, okay, that's a different story. Then you have that vote questioned and those electoral votes questioned, then you go back through a process.
Right.
But you can't do it. Cheney couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. No member, House, Senate, Republican, Democrat, could do it. It would have to be done by a member's motion. That's how you do it.
Right. Now, what
and
I
it
find,
has to pass. And you have to have a senator.
What I find interesting about Ramaswamy is, you know, he's on this voting kick. You know, he wants, and look, I'm not entirely against the idea of paper ballots and a voting holiday. I think those are not bad ideas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's on this kick. Plus, I don't know if you saw his idea of a citizenship for people under 25 to be able to vote. And I'm thinking, you know, Alabama in the 1940s or 1950s and 60s.
That proposal is just so non-starter that I don't even know where to go with it. Now, I don't know if you saw or not, he has never voted in an Ohio primary. He is an undeclared voter in a primary.
Okay.
So he has voted in, I think, 3 general elections, did not vote in the, I think, I'm not even going to quote because I'll mess this up. He didn't vote in a couple of the presidential elections, okay?
Right.
But he has never, as Ohio system runs, you come primary time, you get a ballot for the Republican or you get a ballot for the Democratic Party or if there's an independent. But if you do not ask for a ballot of either party, you are technically, if you've never done that, then you are technically not of that political party. Now, that doesn't stop him from running, but if you look that up, he technically has not declared. He's an undeclared candidate in the Republican side.
Yeah, I just find it interesting that, you know, he's got all of these questions and, you know, he's throwing out all of this, you know, stuff that has some real historic significance, and he doesn't vote the primary. But hey, that's okay, because you had this this Shaker Heights lawyer. I don't know if you saw this story. He voted twice in two elections, in 14 and 16. So he was just making up for Vivek. That should have been his defense. It wasn't that I voted twice. I was voting for my buddy.
I think he voted from another state, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, Florida or something. Right.
No, but it's one of those things where it's interesting. The very people who are saying, oh, there's all this voter fraud out there, seem to kind of maybe possibly be the ones that are, oh, I don't know, doing it. Just kind of throwing that out there. But what do you think of the idea of a citizen, a test to be able to vote? Because I got to tell you, you know, on an intellectual level, there are a number of people who, you know, who say things that make me go, I don't know that you should be voting. You know, I know our system doesn't allow for that, but, you know, kind of, you know, it's just a, you know, a mental exercise. Would we get better informed voters? Would we, if you had to actually know something?
No, because it's just a simple right to vote, no matter who you are, or, you know, whether you've got an IQ of, you know, 120 or an IQ of, you know, 90 or whatever you are, or, you know, your background, et cetera, got the right to vote. That's like, now, we do pick and choose in certain cases, a felon voting. Ohio, once you get out of the halfway house, you can vote in Ohio. In Florida, my former chief of staff, Neil Volz, along with Desmond Mead, launched that whole initiative, as you know, a couple years ago, and they won at the ballot for felons to vote. And then the legislature said, you have to pay your fines to vote. Now, that would be comparable to saying you don't vote until your credit card bills are paid.
Yeah.
Or you're defaulting on your house, so you're not going to vote. You know. So I just think it's a broad brush that you vote. And you just can't start the citizenship test. Just can't happen. I don't know. That proposal of his is just, that cannot gain ground with anybody.
It's wacko. I mean, because he's a wacko. I mean, he got attention because he was the, you know, I believe in any relationship, it's the one who cares the least who has the most power. And the one who's willing to say the craziest stuff, they're the ones who get remembered. And I think that's what happened during the debate. You know, you think about all of these reality TV shows. Who do you remember? You remember the person who was the train wreck. You don't remember the person who was a decent person. You remember the a-hole.
Well, Nikki Haley and Ramaswamy won that debate. DeSantis reminds me of Jeb Bush. He just looks like he's in agony to be there, you know. The best visual on DeSantis during that debate was when they said, would you pardon Trump? Immediately, Ramaswamy and Haley's hands went up. I can't remember who the third one was. Maybe Burgum. I can't remember. But if you look back at that clip, DeSantis is kind of real quick looking left and right, and then he puts his hand up. He was number four, and I'm like, you know, take a stand.
You know
where you're at. You wait till everybody else. But he, you know, he didn't make the big killer hit comments that Haley and Ramaswamy did.
Yeah, no, that's where my point is.
So they took it.
Yeah. Now, I'm not advocating for a citizen's tap. I'm not advocating for this at all. I'm just asking a simple question based on what this guy wants, because I think it's interesting. I think it's an interesting, you know, bit of you know, mental exercise, because I know a lot of people that, you know, I mean, look at Georgia. I mean, you know, the idea that you can challenge unlimited numbers of voters at any time you want is quite remarkable. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Nay, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, sharing some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Got to get your thoughts on this potential impeachment that's coming up. There's a strategy that's being put forth by McCarthy and some of the top Republicans on how they're going to move forward on the impeachment. Not sure what they're going to impeach him for yet, but that doesn't matter.
Well, first of all, there is nothing at this point in time. They couldn't hold an actual vote to, you know, impeach the president. I think that McCarthy has done this to hold his caucus together, not all of them. There's a lot of moderates on the Republican side and in critical districts that don't want this to happen at all. They don't want it, you know, brought up. by the Republicans' own statements, investigation into the Biden family, you know, they make it sound like a mafia, Biden family corruption. By their own statements, they've yet to uncover anything of evidence of wrongdoing by the president himself.
Right.
So you have to have something that you, you know, you base these things on. Now, I think that McCarthy's just trying to give some red meat with, you know, some of his people, the Marjorie Taylor three names and people like that, that want to go back home and say, yes, you know, we're starting the process. It's officially starting.
Oh, and they want to raise money off of it.
Yeah, because what McCarthy says and what he said on the news show on Sunday, he said, if you look at all the information we've been able to gather, it's a natural step forward that you would have that, meaning information, go to an impeachment inquiry.
Right.
And he said a lot of questions remain unanswered. And then he says, in order to be able to get those answers, you need an impeachment inquiry, is what he said. That is a, you know, tap dance way to basically, you know, say that he's starting the process to inquire, but he's really not committed that it can go at this point in time full force. He's appeasing 20 or 25 members in particular.
Yeah. What I find interesting is the very people who refuse to go after Trump for his tax returns are the very people who are asking not just for Biden's tax returns because they're out there, but all of his credit card and bank statements.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. I mean, Trump never had to turn over anything. If there is something shaky in regard to president's personal finances or something of that nature, then, you know, the Justice Department at some point in time, if it launches a secondary investigation on Hunter Biden, you know, would look into that. If all it takes actually is a letter from Congress to the yep. Justice Department, and if they do open up something on Hunter Biden, they would take a look at it. That's, they do that kind of thing.
And I'm supportive of it. But I just find I find it ironic that the people who wouldn't, you know, answer those questions for Trump are saying, right. No, now you've got to give us even more invasive information.
Right. And yet Trump didn't, you know, Trump just, he said when the audit finished, he'd give them. He just, you know, he never gave it to them. Now, the Hunter Biden plea deal turned into a nightmare. No question about that. But that doesn't mean that justice will launch a particular investigation or that they're in the process of it. The plea deal is a separate deal on two other charges, and, you know, with the not paying of income tax and the gun issue.
Lastly, I got to get your thoughts on what's going on down in Georgia and actually in Wisconsin as well. The Republican legislatures are moving. In Wisconsin, there's talk of unseating the Supreme Court justice that just won the election. Not sure why, but they'll dream up a reason. And also in Georgia, they're talking about ousting Fannie Willis, not for cause, just because, of course. You know, this kind of, how do I pose this as a question? How's this normal?
You know, I read the story the other day, and I did not realize until I dug into it that the General Assembly can clearly, sort of like a Florida thing in a way, the General Assembly can vote and can actually, you know, yes, oust somebody based on, I'm going to call political negligence, okay? That's kind of a broad brush they would use. I highly doubt that will happen. I highly doubt it.
All right, so you're on the record.
Imagine.
Doubt it's going to happen.
I can't imagine, yes.
I fear the Republican Party is so lost that it happens.
They might have a vote. They might try to do it. I just can't imagine where it in the end here that it passes. It would just throw, you know, gasoline onto this entire thing. And then you have a new prosecutor. You still have a grand jury evidence that prosecutor would look at. So let me just throw this out here for a second. Let's say they do this to Fannie Willis. Let's say. And they appoint another prosecutor who has still sitting grand jury action. would that prosecutor then come in and null and void the grand jury action?
That's the question, isn't it? Because you would have to assume that whoever they put into that position already been pre-cleared to undo what's been done. So, yeah, I got to think that if they did replace her with somebody else, it would be someone who knows what the marching orders are.
But I can't imagine that they wouldn't have to still go back through the grand jury again to see if there was anything that Fannie Willis did to influence improperly the grand jury. And if she didn't, I don't know how a new prosecutor survives, because somebody could easily file a bar motion for negligence on the part of a new prosecutor. I can't imagine them going down this road. They might try to do a vote that doesn't actually pass because they want to look good in the districts. I can't imagine it would actually come to it, because that would be one of the most chaotic things we've seen in a long time.
Well, I mean,
but it could happen. You know, I can't write these scripts anymore.
I can't either. But Bob, as always, appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Look, it's a brave new world. Who knows what kind of insanity that they will dream up? Who knows how far they'll go? Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day of one of the most iconic stands for justice and equality in United States history. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech to 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. But did you know the official title for that history-making event was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom? The popular memory of the March on Washington focuses on the fight for freedom, especially the right for Black Americans to access public spaces and the voting booth. But the march organizers also understood that economic justice was a fundamental part of this broader call for freedom. As Dr. King once famously asked, "What good is having the right to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger?" This emphasis on the importance of jobs and economic justice perhaps was most represented by A. Philip Randolph. He was one of the lead organizers of the 1963 March on Washington. Randolph was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the nation's first national African-American union. Starting in World War I, Randolph fought for an end to employment discrimination. His efforts in planning the March on Washington were an extension of that earlier work. Organized labor had a mixed response to the march. The AFL-CIO did not endorse the march. Walter Reuther, head of the United Auto Workers, shared the stage in Washington, D.C. with Dr. King and A. Philip Randolph that day. It is important to remember the connection between the call for civil rights and the demand for the right to employment, fair wages, and dignity at the workplace. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So I'm going to finish up with the CPAC guy. Interesting that the Sound of Freedom Party, which is, you know, look, I'm looking at this movie, this Sound of Freedom movie, and it's quite remarkable that, you know, my friends on the right are going, "You don't care about child trafficking." Yeah, I do. I completely care about it. I think it's an important issue. And in fact, we've had people on the show to talk about it over the years. We've done all kinds of things to help in those arenas. I find it interesting, though, that the folks who think this movie is the solution, when all it really is just Hollywood doing what Hollywood does. I find it interesting that the party of the Sound of Freedom have nothing to say about Matt Schlapp, which is kind of weird when you're... I'm not going to make the Schlapp joke. I'm not going to make a Schlapp joke when talking about a guy who chases after young men. I'm just not going to do it. But evidently, the CPAC leader's got a history of grabbing guys by the you-know-what. Unlike, you know, Trump, who was, everything was grab her by the you-know-what, Schlapp is grab him by the you-know-what. And nobody on that side seems to care, which is weird. Because again, there are more allegations coming out, and you're going to find once the floodgates open, he's going to be found to be a serial abuser. You just know how that works. I remember when I was in high school, there was a guy who he was the cautionary tale my mother used as an example when I was a kid, because she went to the same high school that I ended up going to. And this was a guy who had been, you know, molesting boys for 50 years, and everyone knew about it, and nobody ever did anything until one person came forward, filed charges, and the floodgates opened. And this is my problem with a lot of this stuff. It's there. It's just we're not willing to do anything about it. And look, I'm with some of the people on the right. It's as a parent, I definitely want to go after it. You lose me, though, when you start going down these paths of, well, they're doing child trafficking so that they can do human sacrifice, you know, to drink the blood of, you know, babies or whatever crazy Q-kook nonsense comes out of their mouths. You lost me at that. And then to say that this movie, which is pure capitalism, is some kind of organizing cry, and that you know, by you spending your $12, somehow you're fighting child trafficking, is insane to me. But that's what it is. And get ready, we're going to see more of these crazy cute kind of movies coming out. These action thriller, political saga, right wing drivel kind of movies, because now they're profitable. Because you can be the warrior out there just eating popcorn and watching a movie in the dark. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorites. You will find ours. Or just go to therickSmithShow.com. I appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.